This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
We're having a follow-up conversation with Dr. Nico Clark, who's the medical director from the supervised injecting facility, Victoria's very first supervised injecting facility, which is located here in Richmond. Good morning to you, Nico.
Good morning, Tass.
Great to have you back in the studio again.
It's a pleasure.
So, Nico, what's been happening since we last spoke?
So I think when we first spoke, the room had fairly recently opened.
It'd been open for about a month.
And we were pleasantly surprised at that stage by the fact that the local community had were using the room in significant numbers. And since then, it's just really increased consistently since then. So we're now seeing, we've had in the first 4 months, we had almost 20,000 visits to the room.
20,000 visits in 4 months.
Yes, and so we've had up to more than 250 on some days come through the room. And
that's astonishing.
Well, I think it shows that people feel like it's providing a service to them. It's a value to them. People, when they come in, they talk about how they feel safe in the room. We had someone, I overheard a conversation between one client and another saying that, you know, they didn't use anywhere else now because it felt weird to use in the street. It's become something that people can feels like a little bit of a home for them. It's a welcoming place. So,
and I imagine it also feels safe for them as well.
Yeah. So people are vulnerable when they're using sedatives on the street. Often they'll, often if they don't overdose, they sometimes are quite sleepy for a period of time, and people often steal things from them, and they can sometimes be harmed in other ways. So it's a risky time for people to overdose.
I've got to say, you've actually rocked my socks. I didn't expect those sorts of numbers. Up to 250 a day is a lot of people. Mm. And I suspect that it's that people are travelling distances to get to Richmond to use the facility.
So most of the users are local. Mm. They either reside in the Richmond area or they've given us said they slept overnight in the city, and so we think many of them are homeless. Mm-hmm. And from the surrounding suburbs and the Northern Train Line, there are a few people, say maybe 10-15% who travel from further. We don't think that they've travelled specifically to use the room so much as to come into Richmond. And while they're there, they use the room. So they might come into Richmond once a week or something like that. And so then while they're there, they might use the room. They wouldn't necessarily travel to Richmond every day.
Wow. So on average, how long would a client be at the centre for? So they would turn up, they would, you know, register themselves in some way, check in, go and use, and then there's an opportunity for them to sit and relax for a while, I presume.
Yeah, so take up any of the services that might be on offer at that time. So the average is about half an hour. If it's not the first time, it takes about 1 minute to check in, and then people use the injecting room, and that's about 20 minutes on average, including if there's any... the management of overdoses and so forth, that's the average time. And then people will go into the aftercare area, and some will, where the average is about 10-12 minutes, but some people will stay a lot longer than that, and they might have hepatitis treatment, they might have dental work, they might learn how to manage overdoses if they come across somebody else who's overdosed. They might see a GP. They might see a lawyer. We have a lawyer there 1 day a week. They might have and 2 days a week there are representatives from drug treatment agencies who can help link people into different kinds of drug treatment. So there's a range of services that are on offer. There's usually at least one service or one or more services on offer in that room at any given time. And so, But the average, say, is about half an hour.
Half an hour.
I'm interested, Nico, and I've spoken about this a couple of times this morning, that this is actually, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, this facility in law and order terms. And I accept that. I don't agree with them, that, you know, they're saying this is a law and order issue. It's also an issue that I think is actually trumps that, which is about safety, and it's about caring for people that have an addiction and dealing with an issue that is a health issue. It is a health issue, yes. Buying, supplying and using drugs is illegal. But at the end of the day, this is actually about people's safety, and it's about community safety. It's about community amenity, and that people, there are lots of other things at the facility that people can avail themselves of. And we just chatted with Melanie Eagle from, you know, about hepatitis A, and, you know, that there's an uptick there in infections. So when someone comes to the facility to inject safely, there's a whole range of facilities they can access that perhaps they may not have been able to access elsewhere, or that they didn't think to access elsewhere. So you and your staff, when you're engaging with these people, do you, in some instances, you know, say, hey, look, if you'd like to see a GP, or if they tell you they've got a legal issue, perhaps this. So you can refer them on. And these are people that probably before are falling through the net. Is that a fair comment?
Oh, absolutely. So what we do when people first come is we invite them, to the extent that they're comfortable, to share with us the kind of health needs that they have. Would they like to see somebody about drug treatment? Would they like to talk about hepatitis? And we found the most kind of overwhelming unmet need in the community. 40% wanted to talk about hepatitis treatment, 30% wanted to talk about drug treatment. And, you know, we've now had 2,000 people come through. These are, you know, it's a huge unmet need for healthcare from that
so
population.
The overwhelming majority, and sorry to interrupt you, Nico, the overwhelming majority of those folk would probably have fallen through the cracks. Let's assume some of them would not have, but, you know, even if it's as high as half, which I think it'd be a lot higher than that, that haven't, you're talking about a significant number of people that are accessing a service, not just to safely inject, but other health issues, other personal life issues that we as a society think are important. Well, yet apparently some people say they're not important to you if you're a drug user.
Well, you mentioned hepatitis.
Yeah.
So we vaccinate people against hepatitis A and hepatitis B, both which entirely preventable diseases in our community. And we treat typically for hepatitis C, is the most common thing we see. So 1/3 of those we test need treatment for hepatitis C. And we started off referring people for that treatment, and then we found even in that referral it sometimes was difficult for people to take up. So now we treat people on site. We test them, and then when the results come back, we give them the hepatitis medication on the site. Some people pick it up every day when they come in to use the facility. Hepatitis is a huge health priority for Australia. Globally at the moment, with the advent of these new medications, there's a real opportunity to treat hepatitis before it continues to spread further. And there's this estimated 250,000 people in Australia with hepatitis, the majority of whom have contracted that hepatitis through injecting drug use. And now many of those have been treated, but the ones who are remaining are more difficult to treat, and the kind of existing healthcare services aren't really finding them because it's more now within the injecting drug user population than it was initially. And many of them are being treated in prisons, but, you know, services like the one we're providing are the perfect opportunity to, you know, facilitate treatment for people who are otherwise not showing up in different parts of the healthcare system and not often not good at kind of dealing with the appointment nature of healthcare system that otherwise is the way we structure our access to our healthcare system.
I mean, I've spoken about this before. Probably many years ago, I was not an advocate of a supervised injecting room for a whole range of reasons. But my sister died from a heroin overdose. And if there had been a safe injecting room where near where she was living, she'd still be here. I never understood, but I accepted that she was a heroin user, but I still wish she was here. And she'd be here if there had been a safe injecting room. So I say to people, think about that. Think about the families that have lost a family member who's succumbed to an addiction and they're not with us.
Macca, thank you for disclosing your personal story again. That's very generous of you. We are speaking with Dr. Nico Clark from the Victoria's very first medically supervised injecting facility. Nico, last time we spoke with you on air, you gave us some pretty alarming statistics about the number of... I was going to use the words near misses, but that's not really quite right. But there were a number of overdoses that had actually been arrested. And so people's lives were actually saved while they were using the facility. And the sort of numbers that you were talking about at the time were about 20 a week or so, if I recall correctly. What's your experience at the moment, 4 months down the track?
So the four-month data, we've managed 321 overdoses, 299 in the room and 22 out in the immediate vicinity of the room. And 59 of those required naloxone, 59 of the ones that occurred within the room required naloxone, indicating that they're a more serious nature of the overdose. So that's, it's higher than initially, consistent with the high number, the volume of people coming through. It's very difficult to say what would have happened had those overdoses occurred in the street. We have an excellent ambulance service here and the vast majority would have been identified and managed by the ambulance. A significant number wouldn't have been fatal, but would have resulted in a period of hypoxia and probably some brain damage. And it's entirely possible that some of those would have been fatal, but it's very difficult to say how many.
Well, you can certainly say that, those 59 cases, that would have been 59 ambulance call-outs, most likely. We know that Ambulance Victoria is very supportive of this. Paramedics are incredibly supportive.
Don't paramedics now carry naloxone?
Yes.
Yeah.
But paramedics, they're very happy that this facility is open because they're not afraid to deal with these issues. Well, they don't enjoy it, but they're freed up to deal with other medical issues.
Nico, what's just for our listeners, I was reminded by Paul, our panellist, what is naloxone and how is it used and why is it used?
So it's a medication that looks like an opiate and binds to the opiate receptor, but it just doesn't do anything to that receptor. So it
counteracts?
Yeah, so if there's a heroin molecule sitting on that opiate receptor, it binds more tightly, it knocks the heroin receptor off. And so, each receptor is like a switch, and so that switch, which was turned on, is no longer turned on. And so people have a kind of reversal of that opiate effect. So the main problem for opiates is that they stop you breathing. And so if you use naloxone, anti-breathing effect is stopped and people start breathing again. And so if you we start with the smallest dose and build up, because if we give a big dose straight away, you can give people opiate withdrawal and nobody wants that.
No.
But it's very effective in reversing opiate overdose. And it's basically heroin overdoses is the vast majority of overdoses that we experience. There's a small number of overdoses which are a combination of other kind of sedatives. We're seeing an increase in kind of medications like pregabalin, which is sometimes used in pain treatment, and benzodiazepines. And sometimes there's a small number of overdoses that we've seen which aren't responsive to naloxone, and then we have to send those people to hospital. But so far that's been about three. So the vast majority of overdoses we're able to manage effectively either just with oxygen and or some breathing, or with the a titrated dose of naloxone.
So how does your experience here in Melbourne compare with other like services in terms of the numbers, the throughput, the ratio of the volume of people coming through and overdoses that you're dealing with? Is it sort of consistent with the experience, say, in Sydney and in King's Cross and other parts of the world as well?
So if we look at the comparison with Sydney initially, so the Sydney room opened in the there'd been a lot of overdoses at that time. There'd been a lot of increase in heroin use, and then suddenly there was a drop in the heroin market just prior to the room being opened. And so there was a relatively quiet period. And so the numbers were much lower initially, and they built up, and they built up to more than 300 a day at the peak of the Sydney room. And now they've come down from there significantly, and we have significantly more people using the room in Melbourne than in Sydney. They also see much higher doses of prescription opioid use. About half of their opiate use is prescription opiate use, whereas ours is 98% heroin. And they see a significant amount of cocaine and methamphetamine, where we see very little of that 1% of the use that we
see. So is the majority of what you're getting still heroin?
Yes. 98% of the visits to the room are to use heroin, either alone or in combination with other sedatives. Mm.
And Nico, talk to us a little bit about the reaction to the supervised injecting facility. Is the community still unhappy about it being there?
I think it's true that there was nervousness prior to the room being opened. There was, I think people, the image particularly of somebody who's using methamphetamine in an aggressive and uncontrolled way is something that can be quite frightening to people. And we know that our emergency departments do see people like this on a daily basis. But I think, however, since the room opened, people realise it's not like that. You know, Richmond looks more or less as it was, although there's kind of less public injecting and people are less likely to come across an overdose than before. But I think there's been a real shift in the community's openness to the trial. I remember, you know, when we were having discussions like this on the radio, say, 9 months or 12 months ago, there were a lot of people who thought, as Macca was saying before, you know, but it's illegal, you know, there should be a criminal justice response. We can't just let people do things that are illegal. Whereas in the lead-up to the election, there was a very different narrative, and many people ringing in were saying, you know, this is a healthcare response. We should at least, you know, see how this trial goes. It seems to be going well. So I really think there's been a shift in the openness in the community in the last 12 months to looking after, which is a relatively small group of people, in a way that's
great to hear. That's just music to my ears, really. Now, Macca was keen to take the conversation into the future.
Into the future, yeah. But
so talk to us a bit about the future.
So, Nico, we know that you're going to be there at least for 4 years. The government was re-elected and they're committed to this facility. What are the plans for the facility, you know, to update it, to enhance it, you know, to make it more effective? And then I suppose the question is, what do you say to people who still want to make, and I understand it, but still want to make the law and order argument? What do you say to them about this facility and why it's necessary, as opposed to just a total prohibition and, you know, trying, you know, to arrest our way out of this issue? What do you say to that view?
Mm-hmm. So,
the future.
So in the future, so the it's a 2-year trial still. So the future beyond, the legislation allows for a further 3 years, but there is a review process in 18 months' time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and our focus is on preparing for that evaluation that will happen at that point. And then, depending on that evaluation, there's the possibility of another 3 years within the current legislation. We are readying ourselves to open a purpose-built facility in the middle of 2019. The facility that we're in at the moment was designed to be built as soon as possible,
okay,
so to start the trial as soon as possible. But the purpose-built facility, which will have four times the capacity for those additional services that we were talking about before,
wow,
will be opening in the middle of the year. And our capacity, our plan is really to expand those additional services. As we were saying before, there's a really large unmet health need in this population. And we think the best way of addressing that need is to provide initially at least a treatment on site to people as they're coming through. As they come to become familiar with other health services, then they can follow up in other locations. So we'll be expanding the hepatitis treatment, testing and treatment, and vaccinations. We'll be expanding the dental services, expanding the drug treatment capacity. There are some really exciting innovations that we're working with. The dental service has got a I don't know if I mentioned this last time. There's an innovation to treat dental caries. Rather than needing to go to a dentist, you can put like a silver fluoride tincture that you can paint on the teeth where there's caries on the spot. It takes about 15 minutes, and you can immediately arrest the caries in that person. It stains those teeth black,
right.
And so it's not something for everybody, but right. For some people whose teeth are already have fallen out,
or that's right.
They're very happy with that if it reduces the pain. And really what we're aiming towards is giving people dentures, and the first person who's gone through our dental services has received their dentures now.
Great.
And he's just like looks like a transformed person. He's so happy. He goes around smiling at everyone and saying he looks like a transformed person. He said, now I can apply for a job, you know, because he felt that without that, he's got just basically got a badge around his neck saying, you know, I've been a drug user, because, you know, they have that kind of particular look around their mouth.
Nico, based on the successes of this particular service that you're leading now, do you believe that there is unmet need in other parts of Melbourne and Victoria that we really should be looking at setting up similar services?
So there certainly are drug hotspots around Melbourne in particular. Initially, there was the plan for 6 rooms 20 years ago. You know,
I thought it was 5, actually.
Five or 6, maybe.
Dandenong, Footscray, Richmond, Fitzroy, St Kilda and the CBD.
Maybe you're right. All of those places still are drug using hotspots,
yeah.
and there will be consideration, I think, if this trial is considered positive, of whether or not it would be an appropriate service elsewhere. There's a possibility, in getting back to what Macca was saying before, if we can show that a health response is an effective response. Mm. You know, when we talk about, you know, it's illegal, therefore we should have a criminal justice response. I mean, the laws that we have around substances are there for a health benefit. That's in the UN Declaration relating to drug control laws, and also national laws. Then the purpose of those laws is not to increase the prison population, it's to reduce the harm from drugs.
Absolutely.
If those laws are not being seen as the most effective way of reducing the harm from drugs, then when people think about it, they think, well, you know, maybe there is a better way, we should be looking at that.
Nico, thank you very much for your time this morning. I think the numbers are absolutely astonishing. Up to 250 clients a day in what is a temporary facility. And so far, you've actually had 20,000 clients coming through in the 4-month period. We'd love to have you come in again, perhaps as the evaluation unfolds, perhaps yourself and Margaret Hamilton, Professor Margaret Hamilton, who's leading that piece of work. It'd be a great discussion to learn more about that.
It'd be a pleasure, certainly.
Fantastic. Best wishes for the season.
Thank you. You too.
And thank you for your work, Nico. It is saving lives. It's making life for people in that area better. I love, you know, a health response that's really well coordinated and kicks some goals. So well done. Congratulations.
Thanks, Macca.
Pleasure.
Hi, this is John Borghetti, CEO and Managing Director of Virgin Australia. You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Macca.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.